Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Greetings, fellow time travellers. There you all still are. After all this time, we've come such a long way. It's always good to know that we're travelling through time and space together. Before we set off on another journey, I'll say thanks, as I often do, but probably not often enough. And I'll say thanks to all the people who support this podcast series by being signed up to my Patreon.com site. That's the heart of the matter. That's the finances that make the podcasts possible. So if you're one of those, thank you again. On the Patreon site, you get to take part in exclusive Q&A sessions. We do competitions, but you get in touch with one another. You become part of an extended family. You know, you can ask questions of me and of each other, and I answer them, and you share information, and it starts a conversation that eventually spirals off into everything. Archaeology, philosophy, travel, state of society, everything. And nothing's off limits. So, to join, simply go to patreon.com, look for me by name, fill in the boxes, and part with a bit of cash. Join for a month, join for a year. It's cheaper by the year, and I'll hope to see you there. Okay, now it's time to get back to the podcast, so strap into the time machine as we set off towards the next stop in my love letter to the world. Recorder, microphone, action. Ur and Babylon, Egypt, Persia, Greece and Rome. Empires rise and empires fall. Millions of souls on the move, from east to west. Then comes the 20th century and all hell breaks loose. Endeavouring to understand history in hopes of illuminating the future, I'm Neil Oliver and this is my love letter to the world.
Morning, Neil. The last episode was about the horrific terrorist atrocity that destroyed a passenger plane above Lockerbie in 1988. Where are we this week?
Hello, Paul. Hello, fellow time travellers. Yes, that brutal attack, killing all those innocent people, was a seismic event in modern history, and one that haunts me and always will. In this week's episode, we pay tribute to the brave soldiers whose first-hand testimonies have so much to teach us. We're travelling to Britain to pay our respects to a man called Harry Patch. We are in the town of Wells. Well, we're in a residential home in Wells in Somerset. In that residential home in Wells in Somerset, an elderly man died. As you would expect in such a place, can't be a very unusual occurrence in a residential home. The date was the 25th of July, and the year was 2009. And the elderly man in question was Harry Patch. I find it such an evocative name, Harry Patch. It somehow, when you know who he is and what he represents, somehow the sound of his name is appropriate. He was, at the moment when he died, Britain's last surviving fighting veteran of the First World War. And I don't know, Harry Patch, from a man who represents, you know, the 19-teens, just has the right sound to it, I think. Harry Patch. He died peacefully in that residential home. And you have to allow a moment for the significance of his dying to percolate, I think. You know, the last surviving, fighting veteran of the First World War. That's really quite something. You know, when anyone talks and writes about the First World War, the numbers are overwhelming. It's always millions, millions of men this, millions of men that, tens and hundreds of millions of shells and uncountable numbers of machine gun bullets. So to come down to one last British representative, a living link to all of that, takes my breath away. At the time that Harry Patch died, I was already, and many people wired up like me, were well aware of him. He was one of a cast, I suppose, a cast of characters, these extremely elderly men who were the last of the endangered species that was the veterans of that conflict, at least representing it from the British side. Anyone interested in those old soldiers would have come across the work of Max Arthur. He took the trouble to be in touch with those men. He got their testimony. He interviewed them, you know, over a period of time. The book that he brought out, published in 2005, was called The Last Post. And it held the stories of 21 old soldiers, veterans of the First World War. Harry's testimony within the book included his description of Passchendaele. Passchendaele was a name that was applied to the Third Battle of Ypres, and Harry was there. And he described that theatre of war as the single most depressing place on earth. He called it hell with a lid on, which is very, very powerful description, that, you know, hell in a pressure cooker. Only 7 days, just a full week before Harry Patch died, another very elderly man, Henry Allingham, died. I've not mentioned already, when Harry died on the 25th of July 2009, he was 111 years old, which automatically makes someone like me think of The Lord of the Rings, which starts with the Hobbit Bilbo Baggins' 111st birthday party. 111. So I connect Bilbo Baggins with Harry Patch in a way that will make sense to fans of J.R.R. Tolkien's trilogy of books. But when Harry died, aged 111, it was just 7 days after another old man, Henry Allingham, died at the age of 113. And up until that moment, when he died, Henry had been Britain's oldest man, and another of the last of the line veterans of the Western Front. There were only two of them left at that point. And it was almost as if they were in a final competition with one another, but I don't think they were at all. They were aware of each other. And Henry died at 113, and then just a week later, Harry died, aged 111. It's extraordinary stuff. And elsewhere, I described Harry and Henry as the last two leaves to fall from an old British tree, which is how they seemed to me. The dying of Harry Patch, the last of them, was a moment like no other, I would say, in the story of the world, or a moment like no other in my story of the world. I've stressed at all times, you know, this is the 100th story in my love letter to the world, and the one that I, you might say, saved for last. It says something to me about my story of the world. All the way, I've encouraged everyone listening to this to think about what they would compile as their list of the most significant moments, how they would write love letters to the world. But this is my story of the world. And for me, Harry Patch's death was a full stop, an end of a line, a very apt moment to think about and upon which to end a love letter to the world. People my age, you know, we grew up learning to call that war by several names. The First World War, World War One, the Great War. It was called the Great War by those who took part in it before the Second World War proved to be even more of a conflagration. And the First World War was also called the War to End All Wars. Decent people at the time thought that perhaps all of that horror, and it was a horror, could be not justified, but made bearable perhaps by the thought that it was the war to end all wars. We would never have to do this again. And of course, how wrong that was. But nonetheless, there you go, World War One, Great War, First World War, the war to end all wars. And it was all of these things and many other things besides. It's been described as a set of iron railings that separate everything of before from everything that came after. The innocent Edwardian world, all those young men, all those men and boys who didn't know, couldn't conceive of what was coming and stepped out into it as though, you know, stepping onto the surface of the sun just to, you know, be incinerated in a moment. But they didn't know. But these iron railings enable us to see that world of before, but we can never touch it again. It's a stretch through. We can see it and be moved by its innocence, but we can never go there again. And on this side of the railings, everything was made different forever. Harry Patch was born in 1898. There's a whole other century separates us. He was born in Coombe in Devon, near the city of Bath in Somerset. His birth and his death were geographically close together, if separated by a vast depth of time. He turned 18, lucky old Harry, just in time for conscription. So he was just, his birthday fell and then conscription was brought in. There he was, caught in that net. And he became a machine gunner at Ypres, the Third Battle of Ypres, which was known by many who were there as Passchendaele. And he was there for around 3 months. He was there through a summertime, from a July to a September, a three-month period there. And he did his grisly work with the machine gun, one amongst many, until a terrible day came when a German shell, landed and detonated close by his position. And it killed three of his friends outright, and he was very badly wounded. He suffered shrapnel wounds to his stomach, but he survived and they didn't. And, you know, he carried the consequences of those wounds for the rest of his life, and he survived the war. He made it to the end, and after the war, he took up the trade that he had been training for before the war, which was a plumber. He retired in 1963. So he retired 4 years before I was born, and he outlived three wives and both of his sons. And think of that. He lived so long. And I'm minded always, when I think about Harry, of The Green Mile, the Stephen King short story, which became a movie, Tom Hanks and all the rest. And The Green Mile is the green-painted path that the convicted, condemned men walk from their condemned cell to the electric chair for execution. It's known in the prison as the Green Mile, and it becomes a metaphor for the path we all walk one way or another from birth to death. And the lead protagonist in the story says, "We each owe a death, there are no exceptions, but sometimes, oh God, the Green Mile is so long." The character in the story is granted long life, unnaturally long life, a bit like the Hobbit Bilbo Baggins, as I've already mentioned. But in any event, he lives a long, long life, and his path from birth to death is a long one. And I think about Harry Patch and how much he saw after the war, all of those years that he lived after the war, and what a long green mile he walked as well. And every anniversary, every year, when the day came around that was the day upon which he had been wounded and his three friends had been killed, he used to just take himself away. You know, and sit in a room, not talk to anyone. He did it every year in the aftermath. And he would sit in there and think about what had happened to him and what had happened to his friends and what had happened to so many other men. And one of the amazing things about Harry Patch is that when he came back from the war and he got on with his life as a plumber, marrying three times, outliving all of his wives, having children, outliving them, but he never spoke a word about his war. He didn't see anything until he turned 100 years old. And then at that point, he began to speak a little bit about what had happened to him. And what he said, for those that were listening, was that war isn't worth it. It's not worth it. And you have to listen to testimony from someone like that. He was at the First World War. He was in it. He was at Passchendaele. He was firing a machine gun towards other men. And he endured it for 3 months before he was injured badly enough that he could fight no more. And he said, war's not worth it. And to me, that testimony from that one man, that's enough. We should listen to him. Because he was there. He saw it. He took part in it. He committed some of it. And he said, war's not worth it. He said that him and other machine gunners like him would do their best not to kill. That they tried to train their weapons on the legs and feet of the advancing soldiers. They tried to drop them, but without actually killing them, although machine gun bullets to the legs, this is not much of a prospect, really. But he said that the First World War, as he experienced it, saw it, smelt it, was organised murder. His words, not mine. Organised murder. And not worth a single life, far less the millions of lives that were consumed there. And we should remember that kind of testimony from a man like Harry Patch. Because he knows, he knew. And I think about, I've written elsewhere about the unknown warrior. The unknown warrior was a corpse exhumed from, and the details were made deliberately vague, but from one of the great charnel houses of the First World War, Arras, the Somme, others. They raised some bodies, and then one was picked to be anonymous, to be unknown. It came from a grave with no gravestone, so it was an anonymous figure. And he was reburied in Westminster Abbey in London. By that burial, he was to represent all of the dead, all of the unknown dead. And he was called an unknown warrior because it took account of the possibility that he'd been a seaman or an airman, not an unknown soldier, an unknown warrior. He was made that figure. And it was a real person. It was a corpse exhumed from one of the cemeteries. But we don't know who he was. But he was entombed in Westminster Abbey on the 11th of November, Remembrance Day, 1920, when that tradition was just sort of coming into shape. And it says on his stone, if you go into the entrance at Westminster Abbey, he's right there. It's a flat stone. It's set into the floor and it's gated off. And it says on his stone that they buried him among kings because he had done good toward God and toward his house. The more years go by and the more I think about it, you know, I think about the way it was sold back to us as honourable and, I don't know, clean and connected to the work of God and so on and so on. But really, you know, really that death that that individual experienced, so that he was buried without even his name. And he was honoured. He was honoured, whoever he is, was. He was honoured with all the pomp and ceremony that the British Empire could bestow upon him. But, you know, you can't disguise the reality of what happened to him and so many others. And you can't make it a good thing, I don't think. But that funeral for that unknown warrior happened in November 1920. And the funeral for Harry Patch, now that was held in Wells Cathedral. And it was all of 89 years after that funeral for the unknown warrior. They both took part in the same events, and they were buried 89 years apart. It says something, and I don't even know what it is, what it says. But somewhere between those two soldiers, like bookends, somewhere between them, one of them unknown and one of them known, Harry Patch, is the war somehow is suspended between them. You know, like defying Newton's gravity. It's there somehow on a thread, an invisible thread between those two men. You could call them the Alpha and the Omega. You know, the first and the last. Because so much else happened in the 89 years that separate those two layings to rest. And all of it, this love letter to the world, it's all about the Great War, so-called, four unthinkable, unforgivable years. And they drew a line between those two soldiers, and they also draw a line across the story of the world itself, like those iron railings, because everything that came after was different from everything that had gone before. It had to be. It was made different by that man-made hell. And Harry was treated to a very formal funeral. The gang was all there for the event because it was known, it was recognised who he was and what he represented. And amongst the mourners and the pallbearers were the chief of the general staff, you know, the senior military man, General Sir Richard Dannett. And he spoke. I mean, he said fairly straightforward things in many ways, and what you would expect him to say in that situation. He said that Harry was the last of a generation, and that a generation that in youth, these are his words, was steadfast in its duty in the face of cruel sacrifice. And we give thanks for his life, as well as those of his comrades, for upholding the same values and freedoms that we continue to cherish and fight for today. And they're good words, honestly spoken. But they're not nearly enough, I don't think, you know, that for upholding the same values. I don't really know what men like boys, like Harry Patch was 18 when he went to the war. I don't know, for upholding the same values, were they even invited to know what they were getting into? You know, we talk a lot about, at the moment, about informed consent. In another context, you know, where was the informed consent for a boy like Harry Patch? How could he have imagined where he would end up? He was training to be a plumber. And then one way or another, he's at Passchendaele, machine gunning people he's never thought about before in his life. It's so unthinkable that our ancestors took a generation of boys and made them do that. I'll never get over it in a way, which is a silly thing to say because it didn't happen to me, but whenever I think about it, I just can't make it real in my head that grown-ups thought that was an appropriate destination for their children. I just can't make it real in my head. And so, as I said before, this has been my story of the world. And I say, I've always said that we are still in the slow motion aftermath of that war. And indeed the even greater war in terms of scale. I think the First World War is the most significant, but there's no denying that in just numbers and scale, the Second World War was greater yet. And it followed just 21 years later. They only put in 21 years between the end of the First World War and the start of the Second. What an awful and corrupted coming of age that was. And some historians have looked at the years from 1914, the start of the First World War, and 1946, when the Second World War ended, first in Europe and then in the Far East. But some historians have looked at that span and called it a second 30 years war. that the First World War and the Second World War are all one thing with a 21-year interlude, but they're just the war of the 20th century. And in any event, I feel that we still bleed from the wounds of the First World War. I think we're still weakened by septic wounds from the First World War. The ooze pus, metaphorical pus, even now in the 21st century. And sometimes I think of it as being like the heat that simmers out of sight when a coal seam deep underground has caught fire and it's burning and simmering, and the fire is spreading along the seam of coal, maybe a mile underground. You can't see it on the surface, but it's there and it crops up. You know, when we go to war in Ukraine or war in the Middle East, what's happening in Gaza, it's connected. It's all connected up by the fire that was lit in 1914 and that's never really been extinguished. It's just burning, simmering. Sometimes it gets hot enough and it breaks out on the surface. And I think that we're children, grandchildren of damaged generations. I think I've often talked about my dad's dad. You know, my mum's dad was at Gallipoli, but he died long before I was born. He survived the war, but he died when he was younger than I am now. But my dad's dad survived the Western Front, and I knew him. He was alive up until I was in my late teens. And I remember my dad talking about his dad and how his dad was affected by the war. As you'd expect, you know, he was a different kind of dad than he would have been if those two years, my grandpa went in with conscription in 1916, and he was changed by it. How could he not be? And I wonder what kind of man he would have been if he hadn't been in the war. But in any event, my dad, like so many men of his age, grew up with men who were veterans of the First World War. And what must have been going on? I mean, I remember meeting Grandpa when he was an old man when I was born. He was in his 70s. And you know, I didn't know. I didn't have the wit to contemplate the fact that what might be going on in his head. But I think about it now, you know, as he was sitting in his armchair, you know, when we were up there on a visit, I wonder, you know, sometimes about what things might have been going on in his head as he sat there, not talking about it. He never talked about it, really. He didn't really give away any information about what had happened. He didn't keep a diary or write anything down. He was just one of those millions of men that went through it and then had to get on with their lives. But we damaged that generation. And then the generation that came through the Second World War, you know, they were hurt. The people that fought in it and the people that stood and waited and mourned and all the rest of them, there was so much hurt inflicted. And I think to think that by now that we're somehow beyond that 30 years war from 1914 to 1945 is a mistake most egregious. Whatever's happening now, the podcast is all about looking at the past and contemplating the present and the future that resulted. Well, everything that happens now has the First World War and the Second World War in it. It's there. It's part of the psyche of our civilization. The wounds taken on at a younger age that still affect us now. I think the years from 1914 to 1918 were the most transformational years in the story of the world. I think they inflicted more consequential change than any others. And I think that, you know, this love letter to the world has, you know, it started with In Head Joanna and the first named poet in Mesopotamia 4.5, better part of 5,000 years ago. And I would say that what happened to that generation during the First World War was the worst ever. They were the worst 4 years because it was hurt that we inflicted on ourselves. You know, it was no bubonic plague. It was no natural disaster that was no one's fault. You know, an eruption of a volcano or a tsunami or a storm. We did it to ourselves, which makes it the worst. So I look back over the stories, the love letters that we've shared together in this podcast. And, you know, I think about Ur and Babylon, Egypt, Persia, Greece, Rome, and the enormous movements of people and peoples that were stirred up during those centuries and millennia. Wars holy and wars unholy, but always war and war and war again. And that's the background music always, and then sometimes it's to the fore. That's the story of humankind. Cormac McCarthy said in Blood Meridian, war was always there. Before man was, war waited for him, the ultimate trade awaiting its ultimate practitioner. And it's always been there for us. And then I think about how, more recently, others of our sort found the new worlds, you know, North America and Australia and, all of that, all those voyages of discovery. And then eventually you get to the 20th century, and boy, what a century. All that horror. Never before was there such butchery. Never before was there such violation of humanity. You know, in the First World War, you've got horror shows, charnel houses like the Somme and Passchendaele. And then in the Second World War, you know, you've got Stalingrad. And then you've got, of course, you've got Auschwitz and Bergen-Belsen and the Holocaust and then the Gulag Archipelago. You know, shameful, shaming litany, all folded into the 20th century. But I think that, you know, for as long as Harry and, you know, Henry Allingham and the rest, my grandfathers, whatever, as long as they lived, we had living links to all of it. We had people who were really there. They were witnesses, at least. And their testament from their own mouths was real. It was the real stuff. And I've said testimony or testament a few times today, and testament's an interesting word. Ultimately, it's got Proto-Indo-European roots. It goes all the way back to the first spoken word. And testament goes all the way back to something that's like Tristai, which comes out of the Proto-European family of languages. And that old sound means a third person standing by, a witness. And the third man is a phenomenon that I've touched on elsewhere. Shackleton, he had two companions with him. So there was Shackleton and there was Tom Crean and Frank Worsley. They trudged for 36 hours across South Georgia, over crevasses, across parts of South Georgia that no one had ever walked on before, as they crossed to reach help. And after it was all over, and Shackleton wrote the book South about their adventure, he said that he had been aware all the time they crossed South Georgia of a fourth man. There was somebody else there that he never really saw, but he sensed. And he kept it to himself. But then shortly after it was all over, Crean and Worsley contacted him, and they both, independently of one another and without him ever having said anything, said the same thing, that they'd all felt the presence of another. And Shackleton didn't even attempt to explain who or what that presence might have been, but it happens all the time. At times of extremis, people report the presence of an invisible companion that gets them through. And so that idea of the other person, the witness, someone who's there in the shadows, is very, very old. And part of that is within the thought that gives us the word that we have as testament. So testament's an important word. And of course, Harry Patch is gone. He's long gone now. They're all gone. All those millions that were swept up into the First World War, they're all gone. And so now when we come to Remembrance Day, you know, Remembrance Day comes around every 11th of November. And since Harry died, we can't actually remember, because we weren't there. None of us alive today were there. So remembrance has been and will always be profoundly different. For my children and for their children, you know, inshallah, if they have children, battles like the Somme and Passchendaele will ring in their heads like Thermopylae and Carthage. They're mythical. They won't seem real, because if they think about them at all, the combatants and participants will be like figures from legend. And now, of course, by now, the witnesses to World War II, they're endangered. They're an endangered species now. All of those millions are coming to the end of their long lives. And they'll be gone as well. And for all the time that they were there, and there was a time when there were witnesses to both the First World War and the Second World War alive among us, grey sentinels living among us, who were links to those worst of times. And they made it different, their presence. And now we're without them, and so that we're deaf and dumb in some way to the worst of times. We can't see it through their eyes anymore. We can't hear it through their ears. They can't talk to us about it from their mouths. And so everyone alive on the planet can only talk about things that none of us saw or felt or smelt. It's gone now. It's out of reach. I mean, Harry was outlived by other people, you know, because he was the last fighting British veteran. But he was outlived by a Canadian John Babcock, who died in 2010, an American Frank Buckles, English-Australian Claude Jules, who both died in 2011, and an Englishwoman, Florence Green, of the Women's Royal Air Force. And she was the last known veteran of the war from any country when she died on the 4th of February 2012. Imagine that. Let's say her name again. Florence Green. And when she died in 2012, aged 110, she was the last contact to the First World War from any country. What a position to hold, have held. But Harry, you know, he was the last of the fighting soldiers. He pulled a trigger in the charnel house of Passchendaele, and he heard bullets flying all around him, and he saw the consequences of all that he did and everything else that was happening around him in those 3 months. And he was the last. He was the last. And so without him, without all of them, without all of those men and women, all we can do is remember to remember them. Next week, I'll be discussing why history matters in the final episode of Season 2. To help support this podcast and to get access to new content every week, sign up to the Neil Oliver site on patreon.com. I'd love to see you there. I have a new web address. It's easy for these complicated days. It's just neiloliver.com. I've got a shop for merchandise, t-shirts and mugs and hoodies and all of that palaver. My Instagram account is Neil Oliver Love Letter. My YouTube channel is the Neil Oliver Channel, and it features new films and content every week. To help build this podcast, tell your friends about it, get them listening, and write a review to convince the online crowd that they should jolly well join us. For further reading about these moments in time, you could try my book. It's called The Story of the World in 100 Moments, and it's published by Transworld. Neil Oliver's Love Letter to the World is produced by Paul Ratcliffe and Neil Oliver for Catnip Inc. Music's composed by Milo McKinnon. Social media and YouTube producer is Oscar CFR. Additional research is by Evie, Lucian, Archie and Teddy. Finance is by Catherine and Trudy. Post-production is by Squared Studios. And the graphics are by Paul Plowman. Thanks for listening. This has been a Catnip Inc. podcast's production.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.